Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? The speaker is working okay? I find it interesting and very important that part of what can happen through mindfulness meditation or through Buddhist practice or just is not just, is in part a change of perspective, and that a lot of our problems and difficulties don't necessarily have to be resolved in the usual ways, but sometimes involves seeing them in a new way. And seeing them in a new way, we're not grabbed by them, we're not oppressed by them, we don't suffer because of them. Maybe we feel at home again in some deep way, or at peace in some deep way, even though the problem might be unresolved or still there. And sometimes a change of perspective actually is a thing that sometimes actually has a particular problem or difficulty evaporate in itself. And as long as we kept an old perspective, it would be like a maze that had no exit. And so you're kind of endlessly kind of looking for a solution for it, but the solution is not found inside a particular perspective, but rather it requires a shift of view of what's going on. There's a technical word in Buddhism that is, I believe, more or less literally translated as upside-down thinking. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't sound very technical in English. There's a technical word, I think, in certain psychological circles, which maybe works good as a translation. Now it slipped my mind exactly the first word. I've forgotten the first word. There's three words to it. And it's... I'll just make up the first word then. here it is. Yes, came back. Both back. A premature cognitive commitment. And it turns out that the ugly duckling, in the little story, the ugly duckling, is an example of someone who is living by premature cognitive commitment. So the ugly duckling is really a swan, but is born into a family of ducks, and is a really ugly duck, because it's not meant to be a duck. And really, it's the beautiful bird. It's a swan. It grows up to be this beautiful swan. And I guess the baby swan suffered under its premature cognitive commitment. And so that's often the case for us. We have a kind of premature cognitive commitment. We commit ourselves to a certain cognitive view, a certain viewpoint, and then all the stuff follows, including our suffering. And I saw the potential is operating, maybe operate a little bit, but certainly in a fascinating way in my own mind last night. I came home last night and I was going to check my email. So I turned on my computer, and for about a second it started to turn on just the way it usually turns on. And then it had a little poof or something, it did something unusual. And it turned itself off. And no matter how many times I pushed the button, it just wouldn't turn on. So I don't know if that means it's died, or if it's crashed, or if it's just sleeping. I don't know what it means. But it seemed pretty ominous to me. The computer is like my second mind, with all these files on it and emails I'm supposed to respond to and all this stuff that's on it. And so it seemed like it wasn't working anymore. And so I went instead. I went and sat on the couch. My family was asleep. And so I just sat on the couch and just sitting there peacefully. And then it was fascinating to watch my mind. And I think maybe normally enough, my mind started thinking about the consequences of this, what this means. Oh, those emails I'm supposed to respond to, and I don't have access to them, I don't even know where they are. And then there's these files that were such important things that I wrote, and I'll never, you know, and I have this huge, you know, project that I'm working on. I think I have it saved, but it's not the latest version. And how could I ever reconstruct it? And then, you know, well, how am I, what am I going to do to get this fixed? And do I have to kind of mail it to Dell Computer? Do I have to find a computer store nearby? And that'll take a long time. And I have to find a box, and boxes don't come easily. And then how do you pack a computer? I've never mailed a computer before. And I have other things I'd rather do than find a box for a computer. And then go to the post office. And so all these thoughts were kind of going through my mind. And what was fascinating for me was that I could see this, for every little thought like that, I could see a tendency for the mind to want to latch onto it and kind of get caught in that. But all I did was I just watched these thoughts go through. And I was actually quite comfortable to do it. There was a little bit of anxiety, but mostly I was quite comfortable because I was just, these thoughts were just going through, and I could see the tremendous potential to suffer and to, you know, and to have these premature cognitive commitments around, first of all, is it really broken? You know, who knows? Is it, I don't know what's going on with it. Will I ever get those files again? I don't know. You know, maybe I will, maybe I won't. And certainly had thoughts about sending it to Dell Computer to get it fixed. And they would just, you know, in order to fix it, they would intentionally, unintentionally wipe out the hard drive. there wasn't any cognitive commitment to any of these things. I didn't get caught. I wasn't locked onto it. I thought, oh, these are interesting ideas. It might be so. It might not be so. And I've had lots of premature cognitive commitments in the past in my life. And they turned out to be false. So, you know, I think we should give, you know, these ideas a little bit of benefit, not benefit of doubt, but benefit of, what's the other word? What's the opposite of giving it the benefit of the doubt? What? It's a good expression, benefit of doubt. You know, anyway, we should doubt it. We should give it benefit that we, you know, give ourselves the benefit of doubting sometimes these views that we have about before we actually know whether they're going to be fulfilled or whether they're going to be true. So in the Buddhist tradition, they sum up the three, all these different kind of premature cognitive commitments that we might have into three particular views, upside down views or thinking. And some of you are quite familiar with these things. They were the three characteristics. So upside down. So the view that things are permanent in some way, the view that things are satisfactory in some way, and the view that things somehow define who you are, your identity is connected to it. And these are considered upside down views. And the alternative is the view that things are impermanent, things are unsatisfactory, and things are not characterized by being something that qualifies as the definition of self or something we want to identify with or say, this is who I am. And I've seen plenty of times in my own mind, especially when there's a strong emotion, that I know that this emotion or this problem is not going to last, but somehow psychically, my mind operates as if, oh my God, this is forever. This is it. And the change of perspective that sees it, oh, this too will pass, is very helpful. So even yesterday with the computer, I know that sooner or later, this is going to pass. I'll have a new computer. I've lost all my friends. I'll have new friends because, you know, you know, and those new friends will send me new emails. You know, things will change. And I guess that wasn't the best example. So this, you know, that that this particular problem, you know, will be a problem for a while, and I'll have to go through the efforts of somehow fixing this problem. But it's not going to characterize, you know, defining moment in my life, I think, of this is how it's going to be from now on. And so, you know, so for example, sometimes I get angry. And in the moment, it's as if, or sad or something. In the moment, it's like, oh, this is it. This is who I am. this is, you know, I'll always be this way. Upside down view. I'll always be this way. I'll never be happy again. I'll never be, you know, I better not let people ever see me. And I've had that often enough, this idea that this is who I am. And I lose some kind of perspective sometimes in the midst of certain emotional states. And then a day later, or an hour later, a minute later, I'm quite different. And suddenly I feel lighter. I feel like it's middle of winter, but suddenly it feels like spring. You know, everything's light and happy. And I'm kind of, you know, whistling down the street. And what happened to that mood yesterday that I had? And, you know, I was so grumpy. And I figured this is the way, you know, I was going to be the rest of my life. So somehow there's a kind of a commitment to the idea, oh, this is it. This is who I am. Some idea of permanence. Things are permanent. I'm permanent. The problem is permanent. This thing that I have will always be here. And it could be good things. I performed a wedding on Friday. And whenever I perform weddings, I don't often say it during the wedding, but I'm reminded that when people make the commitment to be together for life, it's a setup. For sooner or later, one of them, if things, you know, take more or less the normal course, one of them will die before the other. And that somehow, and I feel like maybe I should say that as part of the wedding, because it's part of what gives, I think, real depth to that commitment. That the commitment of love and the commitment to be present includes being present in this very, very difficult time, and realizing that built into this a commitment of love and being present comes, there will be a time when the couples can be together as one of them passes away, get sick and old or whatever. And sometimes we lose, you know, we don't remember that. And so sometimes remembering that things change all the time. We never know what's going to happen. In the Buddhist analysis of impermanence and emphasizing the impermanence of life, it's not meant to be then heavy or dour or sad or depressed about things being permanent, but it's supposed to lend itself to a certain lightness, being kind of light about the life we live in a healthy way, not kind of floating kind of ethereally, but we don't take things so heavily. We don't get attached or bond, or we're not caught up as so dramatically, but, oh, this is the way it has to be. This is the way it is. There's a sense of not being surprised when things change. And it's very common if you go to Thailand, especially among people who've been involved in Buddhism a lot, something happens and they'll say, oh, anicca. Oh, that's impermanence. As if they're expecting it, as if that's, you know, the way that's natural. It's supposed to be that way. They get a flat tire on the freeway and they go, oh, anicca. Oh, impermanence. What else do you expect? As opposed to expecting things to always work. And then there's this idea of things are satisfactory, which is upside down word or view. And satisfactory means here that somehow it will satisfy in a permanent way your security, your happiness, your sense of identity, that somehow you can get some kind of permanent satisfaction from the things of life. And since things are impermanent and always changing, the idea is that's an upside-down form of thinking. And the more healthy perspective is to see, well, you know, ultimately I can't find some lasting satisfaction in here. There might be satisfaction in the moment, but that's going to pass also. So I'm not going to depend on this for my security. I'm not going to depend on this relationship or in this job or this bank account or whatever. And because if you put some ultimate, you know, dependence on it, it's again a setup. And you might be lucky and it might serve you well until the day you die. But there's lots of examples where that doesn't work out and you don't know. It's kind of like the lottery. And you don't know whether how things are going to work out. And then, for some people, a much more challenging challenge to our upside down thinking is this challenge of a not self, of anatta. The challenge that, our tendency to identify ourselves with anything, define ourselves by this is who I am. And, you know, so for example, my computer breaks down, I won't be able to respond to this email. And I think, oh, they're going to define me, I'm going to define myself as someone who doesn't know how to fix computers, So I'm a klutz. You know, this is a proof of it. So I defined myself by my relationship to that computer was not working. I didn't think I was a klutz until it broke. But now, boy. Or, you know, oh, I'm someone who can never fulfill my responsibilities. You know, and so because the computer broke and I'm never going to be able to find those emails to respond to. So I don't know if those are good examples, but there's some ways in which we define ourselves by our experience. We define ourselves by our state of our mind, our mood, our emotion. We define ourselves, we let other people define ourselves. We're worried about how other people define ourselves. And that's, you know, rampant. We want to be liked, we want to be seen a certain way. And so, I mean, the last thing I should do is come down there and admit to a room full of people that I don't know how to fix my computer. I mean, how embarrassing. This is Silicon Valley. You know, I do know where the start button is, but that's it. Beyond that, I don't know what's there. So there's upside down forms of thinking, or premature cognitive commitments. And some Buddhists then will try to reframe their experience from the proper perspective. They reframe their experience from the idea of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And that can be very wise. I think a lot of wisdom in life comes from being able to see that. To see, oh, this is how it is today, but tomorrow it'll be different. When my son was about 2, it got to be a point where my wife and I would just look at each other and say, oh, it's one of those days. And that would just kind of make everything lighter, because it was crazy with this kid. And they go through these phases, you know, and they go through a day or a week of being a certain way. And my attitude towards it, oh, gee, this is it, you know. You know, it's going to be 18 years of this. We had this really cute kid a week ago, but now, what happened? You know, I must have said something. I've ruined him for life. And I don't know if I can manage 18 years of this kind of behavior. But then, you know, my wife looks at me and says, oh, it's one of those days. Oh, it's just one of those days. It happens this way. And then, the next day it's different, or the next week. And so, you know, I don't succumb to this premature cognitive commitment. So sometimes having this change of perspective, you know, a reminder can be very helpful. Mindfulness practice can help us do that by bringing kind of presence of mind to see things differently. But mindfulness practice is more profound and more valuable. Because rather than taking a view, replacing an unhealthy view or unuseful view with a more helpful one, insight practice is meant for you to see how things actually are. So it's not an idea that you're imposing, but rather an insight into how things are, which I think is much more reliable. Otherwise, if it's just a view you're overlaying, it could have the problem of being kind of wishful thinking or kind of making affirmations on top of the experience which hide what's really going on. And it can be quite fragile if you hold on to the idea of impermanence, when underneath the impermanence is a deep psychic force to want to hold on, see things permanently. Or have this idea, oh, there's no self here. This is not self. And then, but underneath, there's this tremendous drive to hold on to things as self. And that, you know, just kind of like we repress that urge by this Buddhist teaching, which is very dangerous to kind of repress what's going on. The function of insight practice is to highlight what's going on really honestly and have insight deeply into what's actually going on in their experience. And it happens that when you have deep insight, you'll see very clearly that things are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. As something we see, not something we have to believe or view we overlay. So there's a different kind of shift of perspective that comes when we do mindfulness and we see things actually in a different way. There's another kind of change of perspective that comes when mindfulness becomes stronger than the concern we have. So yesterday, sitting on the couch, my mindfulness was stronger than all these very powerful thoughts that were going through my mind. And if I hadn't been mindful, I could have easily been swept up or grasped onto those concerns and been oppressed by it. But yesterday it just happened to be that I had enough presence of mind that I wasn't. And actually I was quite peaceful. And there was this kind of background feeling of peace, of ease, and being quite at peace with the world, with these interesting thoughts going through, you know, with what this all going to mean. So the mindfulness practice, as it gets stronger itself, shifts the perspective into kind of, some people like to call it the witnessing mode. There's a witnessing going on, which is separate from what we're concerned about, separate from what we're thinking about. So those two, mindfulness works in those two ways, in providing us with insight and with providing us with kind of a witnessing mode where we're no longer caught up in the experience, kind of a spacious mode that just sees it passing through. Along this line, are you following me okay? So a lot, anybody not? Should anyone ask a question before I go on? I find it useful to distinguish between foreground and background of what's happening. The idea of shifting perspective into, from not just simply what's in the foreground of our experience, but shifting the perspective into the background of the experience. So, to shifting into the witnessing mode, that sense of observation, or the spacious presence that could be there, is a shift of perspective into the background of experience from the foreground. So let me try to explain a little better. Usually the mind, our mind, I think more often than not, is preoccupied by something, is focusing on something. For example, if you have a desire, or you have something you have aversion towards, then often the mind, the attention, is fixated on that object of desire, object of aversion. And if it's very powerful, the object of the desire or the aversion, then it's consumed by that object. And you're thinking about it all the time, and you're focusing on it, and all kinds of... And it's possible to lose touch with ourselves in the focus on the object. So the foreground of attention is the object of desire, the object of aversion, the thing we're preoccupied with, the problem. Part of the training of mindfulness is certainly to see that, but to train ourselves to drop into the background of what's happening. Not what's in the foreground, what's the background like that's holding it all? And it's fascinating what can happen as you back up into the background. The background is it offers a three-dimensional aspect of our life. It turns out when we're caught up in our thoughts, we live in a kind of two-dimensional world that can seem very rich in itself, but it's really just, you know, it's not as rich as a three-dimensional world. Kind of like someone who's watching television. They're born into a closed room that has no windows or just no curtain, you know, curtains or something, and they spend their whole life living in this one boxed room, one-room kind of house. And there's a television. It's a beautiful television, like a 52-inch flat screen, and you know, state of the art. And every couple of years, someone brings in an even better one, and DVD, and you know, how many channels can you get? Someone told me that she got 600 channels on her television. So I was spending the night at her house. One of her televisions was in that bedroom. So I channel surfed. And I couldn't find, I didn't count, but it didn't seem like there were 600, but it went on and on and on. And so the person saying, "Why should, this is great. If I get bored with a program, I shift to channel and watch another one. And this, you know, so many different colors and programs and every possible, you know, thing I could watch here. It's great." And then after doing that for 45 years, someone finally opens the front door and the person wanders out. Wow, there's a breeze against my cheek, and you know, I can smell the smells, and I can see all this deep perspective, and suddenly there's a three-dimensional world that opens up where the person's used to living this two-dimensional world of television that seems so interesting when that's all the person knew. So our thoughts are like that. Often we live in our thoughts much more than we care to realize, and it's actually kind of a two-dimensional world, even though it can be endlessly entertaining. And the mindfulness is to shift ourselves into the background of our experience, is to start opening up to a three-dimensional world of much more depth of what's actually happening. So with the example of desire, if you pay attention to the background of what's happening with the desire, you might notice that there is a feeling of insecurity. And so the desire is trying to satisfy that, or a feeling of loneliness, or a feeling of emptiness. Or there might be a feeling, might be some anger about something, and the desire is somehow in response to the anger. There might be something that's making you tick that's in the background compared to the foreground of fixating on the desire. Or if there's aversion, there might be fear, there might be a sense of hurt. And so the training of mindfulness is to, part of the training is to change, Zen Master Dogen had this expression, take the backward step. And the backward step means take the step back into the background of what's happening kind of in the three-dimensional world of your experience. When you turn the attention around, away from the object, to what it's like to actually be in this process you're in. So rather than being focusing on the desire, the object of desire, you feel what it's like to be desiring. Rather than being in the planning mode and planning, you feel what it's like to be planning. Rather than, you know, thinking about all the different things that are now wrong with your life because the computer doesn't work, you feel like what it's like to be a person having those kinds of thoughts. And maybe you feel the anxiety or the fear or the irritation or the frustration. So we drop down and actually feel what's going on. When it's something unpleasant in the background, it can be sometimes take some discipline to want to stay there. Because many of us have this idea that, you know, it's, you know, we're supposed to be comfortable, things are supposed to be pleasant, nice, and we recoil from feeling the unpleasantness. And so part of the training of mindfulness is to learn a healthy way of bringing our attention and holding our attention in a loving, friendly way, present for the discomfort we feel in the background of what's actually happening, the three-dimensional part of our life. Now, one of the most useful ways or avenues or entryway to this background of our experience, to make it more concrete perhaps, is our physical experience, our embodied experience. And a very big part of the training of mindfulness is to turn our attention into our body, to experience our life through our body's experience of our life. So not through our thoughts only, not through what we think and the conclusions we make, the cognitive commitments we make, but to drop down and feel, how's the body experiencing this right now? Because the body is not a cognitive commitment. But the body is intimately connected to what the mind does and our feelings. And the body offers an entryway into this three-dimensional aspect of our life. It offers a way of changing the perspective of our experience. What's the body's experience of this right now? Where is the tension? Where is the warmth? Where is the resistance? You know, sometimes you can feel your body pulling back. It can be as simple as paying attention to your posture. What posture are you in different situations, different circumstances? It'll tell you a lot. What you're feeling inside? Where's the tension? And then you're not focusing on the object anymore, but you're focusing on what it's like to be a person in the midst of this process. And the body can give you a lot of information on what's happening. What's going on in the background of experience? There is the I love this the little scene from The Wizard of Oz, where they finally make it to the Emerald City, and Dorothy and her little entourage are in the chamber of the wizard, and he has this big booming voice and kind of seems like a, you know, powerful figure, this big mask on the wall, or a gold mask. And then the Toto pulls the curtains. And there's this little guy, you know, talking into a microphone of some sort. And they see he's just a little guy, you know, and he's from Kansas himself, I think, isn't he? So mindfulness, this idea of dropping into the background of our experience is kind of like pulling a curtain from the director that's often directing the show, and sometimes can seem to have a tremendous amount of authority, to questioning what is it that gives authority to this belief system? What gives authority to this, you know, what's actually, you know, what's making us tick? What is making us tick? So pulling the curtain. And then what happens, we keep pulling more and more curtains. In Wizard of Oz, there's only one curtain. But there you find there's more and more curtains if you step back into the background of experience. You might find, for example, that You know, if you're filled with desire because you're feeling lonely, you pull back the curtain from the loneliness. You find, might find behind the loneliness there might be a feeling of being empty, which feels more frightening. And behind that you might find a fear of not existing in people's eyes. Behind that you might find a feeling of a sense of great space, which feels kind of, you know, you feel unsure whether it's safe to be in that space. And maybe you pull away that uncertainty or that fear of being in space, and you find that being in that great space is actually very satisfying, very comforting. It's like being home in a place where there's no conflict. To drop into the background and keep moving back, pulling the curtains back, rather than fixing the problems there, can reveal a dimension of our life which offers much greater possibility of peace, of happiness, of well-being than you can ever possibly get from fixing your problems. Fixing problems is a useful thing to do sometimes. I need to fix my computer now. I'm going to try my best. I'm not going to ignore that. But I don't expect that to be the solution to my life. I have access, I know about a place of peace, of well-being, of being at home, that is much more lasting, much more satisfying, much more, has much more depth and value to me than being caught up in the concerns of my computer. Or maybe perhaps more profoundly for some of us, whether people like me or not like me. I know that I get caught by that much more than whether my computer likes me or not, whether it works or not. But whether people like me or not, is there some deeper sense of being at home in the universe, feeling like I belong here, that I have inherent sense of worth, does not depend on what other people think. Maybe that's in the background. So to drop into the background of the background, drop into the body, drop into the feelings, drop into the that possibility of being the observer, or observing, watching. To drop into the nature of the awareness itself. The awareness itself that's aware of all the stuff, this game, this dance, this play of life that moves through us. The nature of that awareness itself has an element, a dimension of peace, of timelessness. That's very satisfying when we learn to kind of rest there and trust it. So the main thing I'm trying to say today is that we tend to make premature cognitive commitments. We tend to often have a particular perspective by which we view ourselves and our life. And it's very healthy to begin questioning the perspective that we have, questioning whether it's valid, questioning upon what authority do we have this would be the perspective that this is a true perspective. And then see if you can shift that perspective to a more healthy one, a wiser one. And one of the wiser shifts of perspective is a shift into the background of what's actually happening for you. So focus, turning away from the future, to focusing away from what you're thinking about, to what it's like to be involved in that process of thinking, the process level of our life. And that's part of the function of mindfulness, is to help us make that shift of perspective. And that shift of perspective always brings us into the present. And the present is what then allows us to open up to the possibility of peace. So I hope that was clear enough and useful. So now it's your turn. Do you have any questions or comments?
Is there any cognitive commitment that's not premature?
I think so. I think there can be some. I don't know why you're dressed in a suit and tie today, but I'm wondering if you're going to Courtney's wedding. And that was why. Is she getting married this weekend?
No.
Oh, it's not this weekend. Oh. So, I have weddings in my mind because we had this wedding on Friday. Some of you might know Maria Stratman. Maria? And got married on Friday. And then another woman in our Sangha is getting married soon, September sometime. And isn't that kind of a cognitive commitment to get married? It can be premature. It could also be mature. I think there's some commitments we make intentionally, I suppose. A cognitive commitment to... So certain kind of commitments, so vows. In Buddhism, the idea of vows are very important. A commitment to a certain vow. Now, is that a cognitive commitment? You know, in the form of a perspective. I suppose you're right that that all perspectives, if we commit ourselves to it, are premature. But not all intentions. So you certainly commit yourself to certain intentions. And the Zen Master Suzuki Roshi, he encapsulated Buddhism in three words. Well, at least he did it on one day. And I'm sure he didn't always do this, because the very thing he said means he shouldn't be committed to this. But he said, the essence of Buddhism is not always so. So you're right. All cognitive commitments are premature.
I don't say that. I didn't ask that. I mean, I've been reading this book by Sharon Salzberg, and kind of examining what is it that brings me alive.
Uh-huh.
And perhaps there are some things that are cognitive commitments that are healthy, but I just don't, I kind of have doubt about whether when I make a cognitive commitment, whether it's premature.
Yeah. The general approach in Buddhist practice is strategic. Meaning that the Buddhist word is skillful means. So is it skillful? Is it strategic for a certain purpose? If your purpose is to become more alive, is this view that you want to hold for a while, is it strategic to help you get that in that direction? So some teachers will say the view that things are impermanent, even though you haven't really, don't have the insight yet, to have that view is very strategically useful, because it helps loosen up the attachments of the mind. And helps you then eventually get deeper insight. So, be committed to that for a while until you see for yourself, they might say. So that might be helpful. So there might be particular things which are helpful for a while. But the idea that, this is the way things are once and for all, it's a little bit dangerous to have an idea the mind is fixated on. This is the way things are. To have ideas and say this is the way things are likely to be is probably fine. Anyway, this is my ideas. What are some of you, that's an interesting question he asks. So what are some of you, rest of you, think about this topic? Yes?
I was just thinking that the term premature cognitive seems to imply that it's just cognitive, and that's why, as opposed to something that's cognitive and aligned with an internal core of ethics or an internal sense of something skillful, like something from the heart. So when the two are aligned, the cognitive and the heart aspect, then it's not premature, then it's total, then it's in the present. It's only when it's led by the head with no sense of the other that it's... Uh-huh. I don't know, I thought that was the distinction for me as to why something would be premature.
That's nice, but maybe that we should drop the word commitment, because if we're trying to do is align the heart and the mind, then there's no need for a commitment. Commitment means you're holding onto it. You're carrying it with you as a kind of preconceived idea that you're going to hold, approach everything with. And it might be that it's relatively true. Like Buddhism says, the idea of impermanence is a true nature, aspect of reality. But it's possible to be committed to that idea of impermanence in a way that's not helpful. And it's not really, doesn't really come from insight, doesn't really come from a deep, realization of the heart. But if you have a deep insight, then you might always have that perspective. But it's not because it's a cognitive overlay, but rather it's a constantly renewed insight. So maybe the word commitment is the problem. But, you know, some commitments, you know, we want to put on, just, you know, have strategically. I mean, the cognitive commitment that to the usefulness of paying your taxes, you know, there's a lot of people who really want you to have that commitment. You know, so we say, okay, I'm willing to do that. Yes?
The story you had about the computer and the cascading thoughts you had around that really reminds me of something that I certainly do, and I think a lot of people do, and that is just jumping to conclusions, and then jumping to conclusions from the conclusions you jump to, where, oh, if this happens, well, oh, God, that will happen, and then he'll find out about it, and he'll do this, and then she'll do you, and off you go, and you ratchet yourself up into a state over a sequence of things that, in my case, usually never happens at all. But you go through all the suffering, almost as though it will or it has. And I think that's what went through my mind when I heard the computer story.
that's maybe a better term, premature conclusions. It's maybe easier than this technical word, cognitive commitment, but premature conclusions. And sometimes they one leads to another. And what could be interesting is, then again, this idea of turning the attention backward into the kind of background of what's happening to realize the anxiety that's fueling it. Because there might be some anxiety, and that anxiety propels us to have the next conclusion, the next one. But if we can rest with the anxiety doesn't have to go anywhere.
And also, often you're operating on all kinds of ridiculous premises that A will lead to B, well, maybe it won't, but that B will lead to C, well, maybe B will never come to be at all. And, you know, I obviously speak about this because I watch myself do it. Maybe that helps now that one sees oneself doing this, but I think we all do it.
Yeah. It's very possible that I realize that I'm so much happier without a computer, and I feel so much more liberated, and why would anybody want to have a computer, you know, and I'll just, you know, feel so light and easy and so much time, and I'll just, you know, emails, that's, you know, that's so primitive and thing of the past, and maybe I'll be really happy now. Just other people be irritated with me.
Is it actually broken, by the way?
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't start. I push the button. Maybe it went poof, and then it doesn't start. Oh, yeah. Plugged in. Yes.
I find when I jump to conclusions, I remember, this is Jack Kornfield quoting Mark Twain, I keep repeating myself, the worst things, most of the worst things in my life never happened. I just sort of say that out loud, or I say it to somebody else. It's a good thing to remember.
Mark Twain said something like, when I was 14, I thought my father was just such a dunce. But by the time I was 20, I was amazed how much he'd developed.
I'm reading a book that puts it a little bit differently, and they say we spend most of our time making up stories about things in our minds.
Yes.
The background that you were talking about, to me, really is important, because it's so easy for me to be caught up in the discursive thoughts and to take them seriously, because I'm a very action-oriented person. So I automatically assume that any thought that comes through my mind, I should act on it. Reading the Dalai Lama's book, Dzogchen, has been very useful to me, because I've never heard it as well articulated what that background is, you know, where the emptiness that all phenomena come out of. So I appreciate the fact that you mentioned that today. It's very useful.
Yes?
I'm currently studying a Chinese practice called Qigong. And in that practice, we talked to different organs. And I found it was interesting, as we were doing our meditation, I was doing kind of what we were talking about. I was asking my body, okay, where is the anger? And it's an opportunity, once you get to the root of it, to bring about loving kindness. That's part of the Qigong practice. So I always thought that's something we often don't allow ourselves when we're judging ourselves. So I think that's kind of a plus. So maybe that's okay. What's the word I'm looking for? Cognitive commitment. It's like that may give us some sort of happiness just to be able, or actually I should say reward, to get into that state that we may not want to step into in the beginning.
Maybe, yeah. The your words remind me that a little bit different from change of perspective is a change of relationship. So sometimes we want to change our relationship to our experience. And so one of the ways, one of the changes that's often recommended is to bring loving kindness to it, to bring kindness.
It's reminding me of that Zen story about the man's son, the wild horses. Isn't that the same kind?
Very much so. You all know the story of the...
Tell it again.
Do you want to tell it?
No.
No? It's told in many different versions, but one I heard was some fellow who lived, old farmer, who had a son, a young son, young man. Son was a young man. They farmed together in a very poor piece of mountainous farm, and eking out an existence, and just barely getting by. And one day the old man went up into the mountains, and he found this beautiful horse, wild horse, beautiful, strong, young stallion. He brought it back, and the neighbor said, "Oh, you're so lucky. Now you can farm a lot more fields, and it'll be a lot easier, and you'll raise a lot more crops, and you'll have a much better lifestyle." And the old man said, "Oh, we shall see, or maybe so." And then his son tried to train the horse, and the horse threw the son, and he broke his leg. And then the neighbor said, "Oh, this is terrible. Now you don't have your son to help you with the farming. You certainly can't do it on your own. You're so old, and now you're barely making an existence. Now you're not going to be able to survive at all. This is terrible for you." "Maybe so. We shall." And he says, "We shall see. We'll see." And so then the king of the country declares war on the neighboring country, and he conscripts all the young men. But his son can't fight because he has a broken leg. So the neighbor said, "Oh, you're so lucky. All the other young men are going off, but your son is staying behind because he broke his leg. And this is really great." And so the old man says, "We'll see." The story doesn't have an end. But I think you got the gist of it. It goes on like, "We shall see. You don't know how things are going to work out. You don't know what's going to happen. We'll see." So, last one, yes.
I had a question about when you're talking about the views to remember impermanence and satisfactory. No self. The unsatisfactory part refers to the suffering aspect or that clinging.
Yeah.
Is that referring to?
Yeah. The Pali word for is dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, but often enough, explaining it in this situation, is translated as unsatisfactory, and that makes a lot more sense, I believe, for that. The word dukkha has a kind of wide range of meanings, and so probably means other things besides just suffering. But it's unsatisfactory for these things that we want to get satisfaction for.
So that when you pull back, then the feeling is that you don't expect to necessarily gain satisfaction out of a situation. Like if, say, you're angry or in a conflict, and I can feel that I'm feeling disappointment, that's part of what's going on for me. I might pull back and I may or may not be able to stop the conflict from happening, or the words from flying, or the feelings from feeling. But I feel that disappointment then remembering that I will, that disappointment, that you will feel disappointment.
Yeah, maybe so. It's very useful to drop back and feel what's going on, because then we're less likely to act impulsively or unconsciously from those feelings. Mm-hmm. You know, say something we didn't mean to say, so, and take responsibility for how we're actually feeling. I think the idea is we're not depending. Our own sense of well-being or feeling at home or being at peace is not dependent on the resolution of a conflict. It doesn't mean we don't try to. It doesn't mean we don't necessarily feel some kind of disappointment if it doesn't work out. But we're not disappointed in some deep way because we've kind of invested our own happiness in the outcome of the conflict. So it's unsatisfactory as a source of permanent security, permanent well-being, permanent feeling at home in this universe if I resolve this conflict. We still might want to try to resolve it, but we're not depending on it for our deep peace.
What is the word for a premature cognitive commitment?
Oh, the Pali, I don't know the Pali word for it, but the translation of the Pali would be upside down thinking. Great. Thank you.